T2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done many Sundays over the last 36 years. As you guys know, it's a gathering of people who are curious about radio and wireless equipment, and they gather and share their information with each other. As I've said so often, really want somebody who understands an antenna, you better hire a ham radio operator. And when it comes to wireless equipment, radio equipment, arguably the antenna is the most important part. You can have a perfect receiver, a perfect transmitter, and if you don't connect either one of them to an antenna, you don't have communication. So the most common vital element there is the antenna. And antenna theory is a bit mysterious, the way it's represented in the books. There's a lot more to the story than the books or the classes reveal. Maxwell's equation gives you some so-called fundamental information, foundation information. But not many people can look at Maxwell's equation and say, yeah, I know what's going on. The TechNet is broken. Let me drop it. Into three sections these days. First section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. They give us their name, their call letters, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. Need not sign in just because you're listening after 36 years. We believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. The second portion of the TechNet is run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who handles the mailbag and science talk on many subjects of NASA and space science and physics and so on. Third section is run by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report, in which he tells us what each of the organizations throughout the world that are involved in space, what they're doing and when the next launch is going to be and what their vehicle will be like and how is it powered and so on, and the names of the astronauts, cosmonauts. Let me drop again. The TechNet, the last 12 years of the TechNet, I think it's 12 or 14 years, is all recorded. You can play it back by going to the website of amateurradio.tv, amateurradio.tangovictor. Go there, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back past TechNet. The first few years are documented as to what was discussed during each half hour of the TechNet. That got dropped later on. That's a very enthusiastic, that whole project of all those recordings is very enthusiastic, done by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. So, amateurradio.tv. When Roy gets on, he'll be giving you his addresses as to some very interesting websites he has created, which give you other places to go and other things to see and do. Okay, this time we're going to take the sign-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this. AC2GS, Roy, and yes. So, if you've got a question or a comment, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
N2EO with a question and comment.
WB2EVC, Barry, with a question.
KG2RY, David, with a question.
Okay, we got Rich. Barry, let me make sure I got you right. Whiskey Bravo 2 Echo Victor Charlie. Is that correct, Barry? Since he didn't object, I assume so. And David, your call is KC2RY. Do I have those call letters correct, David? Go ahead.
Almost. It's Kilo Golf 2 Romeo Yankee. How are you tonight?
Okay, thank you, David. Kilo Golf 2 Romeo Yankee. Alrighty. One last call. Anyone else to check in who has a question or a comment, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Okay. We got more than enough to get started. First person on the list was N2EO. Go ahead, Rich. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. N2EO, good evening to all. My question, and then later my comment. I read that article again on the modifications to the Henry 2K Classic Amplifier. It sits on the floor. It weighs over 100 pounds. You may want to look at it, a picture on the internet while I'm talking, Dick. The person who wrote the article said the minimum requirement for a 3-500 tube is 13 CFM. Two tubes, of course, 26 CFM. And he states that the fan in there is barely enough. He feels it's about 30 CFM. I'm going to change the fan like the blower. It's a squirrel cage blower. The one this gentleman used was made, I don't remember the company, I'll have to look back. But because it had an air switch, it was over $200. A lot of money for a blower. I wonder if you've ever heard of a company called Dayton. Just like the name Dayton, Ohio. They have a 65 CFM blower for about $70. I wonder why the difference. I wonder what you used on your classic RIW kilowatt. And are all the flanges... See, the guy said this blower fit right in. Are those flanges a standard? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that Dayton blower, I think, is being sold by the Granger Company. And Granger is a industrial supplier of electrical and mechanical equipment. And because it does do such a large amount of business, their prices are reasonably, are often very reasonable. So a Dayton blower sold by Granger could be a good product. And whether or not the flanges do or don't meet your cabinet, meet, you know, the holes line up and so on, that's a minor detail. To make an adapter plate would be pretty easy to do. When it comes to whether or not your tubes are getting enough air, assuming there is one common air output above each tube, I'm not sure if it's true, but if there is, and if you put a candy thermometer there and you measure the temperature of the air coming off, that'll give you a pretty good clue as to what the possible temperature of the tube is. And somewhere in the transmitting tube manual of RCA or others, it must tell you what's the maximum temperature you should allow the glass envelope to go to. So, just having the right number of CFM may not be enough of the story if you don't know exactly how the air is being directed. If the air is really being directed correctly, a smaller number of CFM could be adequate, and vice versa. If the air is going all kinds of places, then a high amount of CFM might not be adequate. So those are a couple of comments I've got on that one, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW. I think that was HUC. Your signal was very noisy, so if you can do something to make it a little stronger, go right ahead with your information.
Better, Dick?
Huge better. Now you're dead for quieting. Please proceed.
A couple of things. One, as you pointed out, Dayton's brand is by Granger. Granger's not going to sell to a person. You have to have a federal tax ID number, a corporation, in order for them to do business with you. That being said, do not put a Dayton fan in an amplifier. I made the mistake. I spent the money. And while it does deliver perfect CFMs, they are very noisy. They are not made to be in ham radio equipment. People could hear my amplifier humming in the background from my microphone. And I moved it across the room, and they still heard it. So I ended up having to go back, pull it out, and buy an actual fan from Ameritron and put it in and replace the Dayton because it was just way too noisy. That's my two cents. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay. Well, thank you. I don't know if they're all noisy. This is a squirrel cage blower, not a fan. And there is a difference. Dick, what did you use in the RIW kilowatt?
Right now, I don't know. reason I don't know is that the fan was not mounted to the cabinet of the amplifier. I had a separate cabinet with the blower contained in it with soundproofing material, and one whole wall of that cabinet had an air filter. And I put the blower, in my case, I put the blower in the basement with a piece of air duct tubing coming up through a hole in the floor, coming up to the amplifier. That way, even though I had a noisy blower, it was another floor below me, and I didn't hear the noise per se. So that's the way I did it. I didn't say it's the ideal way, but it's the way I did it. Back to you, Rich, N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, fine. I've actually known from the other gentleman that he purchased from a Metatron a fan, or did he purchase a squirrel cage blower?
Mr. HUC, what did you use, and what it cost, where'd you buy it? HUC, K2IW.
In a particular case, it was a fan. However, the noise was not a result of the fan. It was a result of the bearings. And they were these cheesy, you know, there's a reason why the fan cost, you know, I think I paid whatever it was, $40, $45 for it. And I got it through a friend of mine who was able to order it from Granger for me, because for the same reason Rich was looking at it, it's, you know, how do you beat that price? But it had a god-awful, I don't want to say it was a hum, but it was, you know, with ball bearings, and the ball bearings just made a racket. You know, it wasn't made for electronic equipment. And I don't think that you're going to see that big of a difference with a low-budget blower either. You're not going to get the buffeting that you would get from a fan, but the bearings are still going to make a racket. My advice to Rich is get the right...
He cut off at the very end, but I got him. I don't believe a good squirrel cage blower is going to make a racket. I was not looking at Granger. I was looking to buy it direct from Dayton. They do sell it direct.
Yeah, I've walked into a Dayton store and bought things. So, the restriction they seem to have, I'm not sure that each of the outlets of Dayton honors that restriction. So you may be able to get it that way. Okay. I'm going to go over to the next person on our list, which was Barry. To be B2 Echo Victor Charlie, I think it is. K2RIW. You got it, Barry.
Dick, I have some comments. Put me back at the end.
Why don't you give us your comments right now? Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, two comments. First of all, years ago, I figured out a way to take scratches out of clear plastic, dial windows, whatever. And what I did, believe it or not, I used toothpaste on a baby wipe. It's a polishing compound. It takes a little while to do it, maybe an hour, to polish out a minor scratch. And probably a better thing, although I haven't tried it, would be Jewelers Polishing Rouge. What do you think, Dick?
I don't have any experience with either one, but both of those substances contain abrasive material, and that's how it works. There's a mild, very fine abrasive material in toothpaste, helping it to grind away the tartar that's on your teeth or the plaque. And the Jewelers Rouge also is an abrasive. So, and it probably comes in various colors with various grit sizes. So that you could probably, if you want to, go to finer and finer grits for even getting rid of the microscopic scratches that the grinding compound is using. I'm going to pass it back to you, Rich. Drag your feet in case anyone else has anything you want to add to that one. N2EO with a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. On another subject, a lot of people still think MFJ Mighty Fine Junk. It's not so anymore. They've improved their quality tremendously. They use good quality circuit boards, service mount components in some cases. Anyway, I had a problem setting up this device I'm using now. It's called a microphone radio switch. It allows you to use any brand microphone. I'm on a Kenwood mic on any brand radio. I'm using an Icon radio. You can select with a button Radio A or Radio B. This radio is on Radio B. My HF radio, which is a Kenwood, is on Radio A. I did have problems setting it up because there's a zillion jumpers in there. I called the fellow. His name is Richard Stubbs. S-T-U-B-B-S. Let me get it dropped. Richard Stubbs is in charge of customer service at MFJ. He turned me on to one of his associates, a technician named Hank. Hank figured it out for me. It took him hours. He got back to me. It was still a little problem. He stayed on the phone with me for over an hour and a half. MFJ is very helpful if you know who to go to. I'm going to give you MFJ's phone number. You'll get a recording. Don't worry. Press zero. After a couple of minutes, a secretary will pick up, and you ask her to speak to Richard Stubbs. So I'm going to give you the MFJ number. Hold on. Okay, it took a while for him to bring it up. It's 662-323-5869. You'll get a recording on that number. Don't worry, don't wait for the recording. Press zero and ask for Richard Stubbs in customer service. I'll give you the number again. 662-323-5869. They're extremely helpful. And it's a better company. They've improved themselves quality-wise. There's nothing wrong. They're no longer mighty fine junk, as some people think. I've ordered enough MFJ stuff to know. Back to Net and to Leo.
Thank you, Rich. Good information. I'm glad you had such a helpful a person aiding you with that microphone circuit. Now we're going to go over to Barry. WB2 Echo Victor Charlie, I think it is. You've got it, Barry. K2RIW. Okay, maybe I've got the call letters wrong. Barry, are you there?
Yes, but it's Nancy. Yes, but it's necessary to speak into the correct microphone.
Okay, we're hearing you now, Barry. Go right ahead. And it is Echo Victor Charlie?
Yes, it is. And I think I did the same thing earlier when you asked me to confirm my call. I think I was talking into my HF mic. Well, all right. That notwithstanding. My question is fairly straightforward. I've just recreated an antenna, 2-meter antenna that I originally used when I first got on the air in the early 60s. It's a coaxial antenna, very, very straightforward in terms of construction. The lower radiator is half-inch copper tubing, and the upper radiator is quarter-inch aluminum rod. The feed line goes in through the bottom radiator, through the half-inch copper tubing. It connects to the end of the copper tubing at the junction, and the semiconductor goes to the upper radiator. My question is, what is the correct length of the lower radiator? Should it be a quarter wavelength, 19 inches on 2 meters at 146 megahertz as a typical center-fed dipole, or should I shorten it to compensate for the velocity factor of the feed line? The theory being that the lower radiator is both a radiator and a bazooka choke that keeps RF off the feed line. So I can't find any definitive literature online. I see that some people do shorten the center, do shorten the lower radiator, and some do not. So I'm just looking for some opinions here. Back to the net.
Yeah, that lower piece of copper tubing is a bazooka ballon acting as an RF choke as far as the current flowing down the outside of the coax cable going any further than the antenna. Now, the exact length of the radiator and the exact length of that bazooka are some of the variables you can play with. By that I mean you can calculate ahead of time. Yes, you've got some dielectric material, the plastic on the outside of the coax cable is part of the dielectric, and the center conductor itself is making that bottom bazooka a kind of a coaxial transmission line, so to speak. Approximately a quarter wavelength long is the right ballpark. But if you really want to get a perfect standing wave ratio, you don't need it. Anything better than 2-to-1 on most 2-meter rigs is more than good enough. You never lose more than half a dB of signal in the worst case with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. But the average ham would like to get a 1.1 if he can get it. And if you've got some kind of a standing wave ratio indicator, it could be a Berg watt meter looking at forward and reflected power. It could be a network analyzer, an antenna analyzer. Any of these devices, you could do some playing around with the length of the driven element and the bazooka in order to make the standing wave ratio better. Let me drop. Now, at first, one of the directions to go to make a test improvement would be to shorten either one, and you'd be reluctant to do that because once you cut away some of the copper tubing or some of the aluminum radiator, it's hard to put it back. You can find out what's going on by putting on pieces of copper tape. Put a small piece of copper tape on the top of the aluminum radiator and see as you add more and more copper tape, is the standing wave ratio getting better or worse? It'll give you a hint as to where the bathtub is, even though you can only see the upper half of the bathtub, so to speak. And the same thing when it comes to the lower copper tubing. By putting on pieces of copper tape around the perimeter of the lower piece of copper tubing, you can make it electrically longer and find out what's happening. And even if you do some cutting and you cut too far, putting in the copper tape to fix that is a good solution. There's ways of weatherproofing the copper tape so that it would last. So by way of these tweaking procedures, and there are other tweaking procedures, putting a large piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick and holding it near the tip of the radiator will be adding length. Holding it near the base of the radiator will be canceling some of its reactants and will be making it electrically shorter, if you know what I mean. So by way of gimmick tuning tools and pieces of copper tape and an antenna analyzer, you could make it perfect if you want to. It's an academic experiment, but a lot of people enjoy doing that. Over to you, Barry, WB2EVC, K2RIW.
K2RIW, WB2EVC. Yeah, some good insight. Let me just tell you what I have done so far. I'm using a grid dip meter. I found that the original construction, 19-inch upper and lower radiators, actually resonated at about 142 megahertz, which I thought was a bit odd. So I shortened the bottom tube and actually made it adjustable. I slid the piece that I cut off and slid it over the end of the lower radiator so I could, you know, move it up and down. And while I was able to get the resonant frequency right to the middle of the band that way, the SWR was not very improved. Well, over 2-to-1, close to 3-to-1 in the center of the band. And really not sure what's going on here, and that's why I'm asking about, you know, what the correct calculation should be. But it never occurred to me to use copper tape or something similar on the center, on the upper radiator. I think that's a great idea, and I think I will give it a try. I do have an SWR bridge that appears to work, so you know that's some indication I can use. And my grid meter is reasonably well calibrated, and it does give me a pretty sharp resonance on the antenna. So I'm just curious about, you know, resonance versus SWR. Let me turn it back to the net. WB2EDC.
Hey, you've used some good common sense, Barry, but this is one of these places where it will fool you. Almost all transmitters are not a 50 ohm output impedance. They give best performance when loaded with 50 ohm, but you look back into that transmitter, and there are ways with difficulty where you can look back into it while it's transmitting and measure its impedance, and you will not see 50 ohm. You'll see something closer to an open circuit. That's if the transmitter is turned on. If the transmitter is turned off, you'll see some other crazy impedance. So when you're using your grid dip meter, you're measuring the resonance of the antenna with the transmission line of some particular random length connected to a mysterious impedance device called transmitter. That pulls the frequency somewhere else. So using the grid dip meter to get the resonance right, assuming that you get the resonance exactly on 146.85, that you're going to get the best sustaining wave ratio, 146.85. Not at all. And in some cases, because portions of the antenna might be inductive and other portions capacitive on more elaborate antennas, just making the grid dip meter give the right number is not exactly the right way to do it. So by way of a bird watt meter or an antenna tuner or a vector network analyzer, looking at the antenna while you're transmitting into it a pure sine wave signal and adjusting for the least amount of reflected power, that's the right way to get the impedance of the antenna right. And your grid dip meter, because of that transmission line hanging on it, can give you a phony response, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Barry, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, WB2EVC. I do understand what you're saying. Transmitter and the feed line coupled to the GDO. But yes, I do understand that the output impedance of the transmitter may not be 50 ohms, and did not really think about that very much. So good insight again. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It gives me some things to work on. You know, I do appreciate the tip about the copper tape and, again, enlightenment about the transmitter. K2RIW, WB2EVC.
Yeah, as you discovered, there are lots of ways of adding gimmicking tuning devices. You've got a sliding piece of telescoping tubing on the bottom of the copper tubing. That's a good way to go. Copper tape. And by the way, the copper tape, you would think that you have to use large and small pieces. You can use a medium-long piece of copper tape, and with a long wooden stick standing off at a distance, you can be bending over the copper tape, and therefore you can electrically change the length of the driven element in a continuous manner by bending the copper tape, the part that's overhanging, if you know what I mean, with a long wooden stick, with you standing far enough away from it, and watching the standing wave ratio, reflected power, or watching the indications on your antenna tuner, antenna analyzer, while doing that. And there's various ways you can make a sliding piece of metal with a tightening screw on the driven element. So there's lots of ways you can be tweaking the length, and so by adjusting various things, gimmicking, even adding a piece of copper tape near the base of the antenna that comes close to the copper tubing, that would add base capacitance. So by way of copper tape and bending it and putting it close, you can add capacitance to the base. You can add and subtract length to the driven element. The reflector, the bazooka, you can change its electrical length. By using all these gimmicking, adjusting mechanisms, if you care about it, you could make the standing wave ratio of the antenna absolutely perfect. In the case of a pure dipole, let me drop. By adjusting the length of the dipole and the shunting capacitor across the center of the dipole, you can usually make the impedance of your dipole perfect. At first, it seems like a lack of common sense. But Once you make the dipole longer than required, it is inductive. Putting a shunt capacitor with gimmicking copper tape, but you know, copper tape on one side and scotch tape on the other side, acting as a capacitor to keep it from shorting out. There's various ways you can make a shunt capacitor, a variable shunt capacitor, at the center of a dipole. By these juggling techniques, you can make the impedance of your dipole absolutely perfect if that's what you want to do. And there's cases where the driven element of, say, for instance, a Yagi being used as a moon bounce array, there's a strong motivation. Let me drop this. A strong motivation to make the impedance perfect, because you may have very carefully tuned your low noise preamplifier that's mounted at that moon bounce antenna on an automatic noise figure indicator, which has got a pure 50 ohm source impedance. And so your low noise amplifier is giving its best performance when it sees pure 50 ohms. But when it sees any other impedance, the noise figure will be different. So making the antenna impedance better than just 2-to-1, there's a strong motivation for doing that if you're looking for the last half or 1 dB of performance on a moon bounce antenna. So tweaking antennas to get the best standing wave ratio, not as complicated as you think, and works a lot better than you think. Next person on our list was David. Kilo Golf 2, Romeo Yankee, K2RIW. You got it, David.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Good evening, and thank you for accepting my question. I have a bunch of dual band radios. They're 2 meters and 440, and I've got like maybe a whole stack of antennas for those particular radios. Some of them would require an adapter. And I guess the strange thing that I'm experiencing is, you know, they're all of different lengths and different designs, you know? And somehow I get results that I wouldn't normally expect. I mean, you would think that if the antenna's longer, that you'd have better results with it. Could you talk a little bit about this, Dick? Back to you, sir.
This is very similar to the problem people had a decade or two ago when handy talkies were coming out, and most of the handy talkies had a rubber duck antenna on it. And you'd like to believe there'd be a company selling you a rubber duck, and you could plug it into a Kenwood, ICOM, Isu, or whatever brand of handy talkie. Not true at all. In fact, when you were at a flea market, and if the flea market guy was selling rubber duck antennas, he had a whole bunch of rubber duck antennas on a shelf with labels alongside of them, or maybe they're all attached to a metal plate with labels alongside of it, and you have different rubber ducks for the different brand names. In order for an antenna to work well, it must resonate at the frequency you're using it at. But the resonance is a function of how long is the antenna and how well is it wound, in the case of a rubber duck, and what is the output impedance of the radio that's feeding it. You could put if you wanted to, you could put an antenna tuner inside of the radio, taking a rubber duck that's too long or too short, and with the antenna tuner, tune it to the right frequency and radiate very well. So each brand name of handy talkie has their own favorite final amplifier, and it has its own amount of capacitance, inductance, impedance, and whatever, and therefore they have a slightly different rubber duck that gives the best match to that particular anti-talkie. Let me drop. By a similar technique, the antennas that are used on old radios, again, they worked best when they resonated at the frequency that they were that you were tuning the radio to. But because there's so many different ways of setting up that input circuit or input circuit, in the case of a receiver, there's so many different ways of setting that up. So different designs of antennas will, with that particular radio, give performance, and that particular antenna plugged into another radio may not give very good performance. So that's part of what I think is going on. I wonder if you see a little bit of the theory of that one, David. KG2RY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW from KG2RY. QSL, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, let's say you have two antennas. One is made by Nagoya, and the other is made by Comet. The Nagoya antenna is about 8.5 inches long, and it has a base. And the Comet has 6.5 inches long. It has a smaller base, you know. Both antennas were designed, you know, for the kind of radio that I have, you know. But for some reason, the Comet, the shorter antenna with the smaller base, works better, specifically on 2 meters, you know. I would think that the Nagoya was designed for Baofeng radios. But I guess, you know, for that kind of thing, it's probably, you're probably not sure what you're getting. Would that be a correct assumption? Go ahead.
Yeah, the antenna designs for various radios is a little bit spooky. Each engineer designing that radio, interfacing it with an antenna, and the antenna maybe was designed by another department, maybe the same department of the guy that's designing the radio. They got their favorite ways of doing things. You could, if you wanted to, take each of those antennas and started adding gimmicking devices to the antenna to find out if you can make the performance of a particular antenna on a particular radio work better. Listening to a weak signal while adding pieces of copper tape near the tip of the antenna, the middle of the antenna, the base of the antenna, bending the copper tape with a long wooden stick so that the piece of copper tape overhangs longer or shorter pieces, making the copper tape near the base act as a shunt capacitor to the base of the radio. Even though it's a plastic package on the outside, don't worry about it. You still can simulate a capacitor. So you could do various tweaking techniques on each of these antennas and find out for your favorite frequency what works the best. So you're going to see lots of differences of design, and there is no common denominator. Nobody has a cookbook saying that if you're building an antenna for this particular frequency region, this is the way the antenna should be built. Nobody has ever made a book like that. So almost each brand name has got a different kind of an antenna and a different input impedance to their radio circuit. Over to you, David, K2RIW.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Yeah, well, you know, I noticed a very, very significant difference with the Comet. And the Comet is a smaller antenna, it's a thinner antenna, and for some reason it resonates really well on 146.850. You know, I can't figure it out, you know. And from my experience, you know, in the city, trying to make that repeater, you know, I've had absolutely no luck up until now until I got this little antenna on the radio. So maybe the signal is bouncing off of a building or something, but, you know, I was quite surprised. And, you know, I think that this antenna is constructed a lot better than the Nagoya. I think it probably has better quality control. Go ahead.
Yeah, from the outside of the package, that's not always easy to tell. In the very early days, rubber duck antennas, because the final stage of the handy-talkie didn't have anywhere near as much protection as modern-day transistors do. In the early days, if you if the transmitter looked into too poor an impedance, you might get a failure of the final transistor. Nowadays, the Stucci transistors, the beefy transistors they put in rigs, can tolerate a direct or short circuit or open circuit, no problem. But in the early days, rubber duck antennas used to be made out of nichrome wire. So the resistive wire of the rubber duck antenna made it a good impedance, even though it was rather inefficient as an antenna. And so that's part of how people started saying that rubber ducks are terrible antennas. Well, in the early days, they were. Nowadays, they don't do things like that. Now, whenever you're in a complicated area.
Hmm.
Almost every place is complicated. Particularly in New York City, you've got all kinds of buildings nearby. And if you take your handy talkie, hold it horizontal and vertical, point the antenna toward the repeater, away from the repeater. So you're changing the orientation of the antenna, of the rubber duck, and translating it in X, Y, and Z while listening to a weak signal. You'll see the signal peak up and go back down and whatever. Let me drop. And almost all of that is because of multipath. That radio signal that you think is going directly from your rubber duck to the repeater when you're transmitting, it isn't doing that at all. It's bouncing off of everything in your environment, both transmit and receive. And so, and the environment, too, can easily, because of a complex reflection, can change the polarization. I get the strongest signal on my handy-talkie in my bathroom on 146.85 when I lay the handy-talkie horizontal on a plastic shelf in the bathroom. I know that the signal coming out of 85 LIMOC is a purely vertical signal. But by the time it gets to me, the strongest signal with all that multipath is horizontal. So, you'll see, choose a weak repeater and do that translation and rotation, and you'll find all kinds of peaks and valleys throughout your room. In fact, I've been told that there is a pretty deep no in the reception on 146.85 near Perry Street. Around 55 Perry Street, there's a pretty deep no in that area. Over to you, David. KG2RY, K2RYW.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Now, I didn't hear any repeaters there, but maybe one day there will be one that I'll know about. I'm basically sitting in the southwestern part of the park, in the corner, and on one side there's like three or four wooden benches, you know? And that's where I get the best signal for 146.850. And all I have to do is hold the HT in a normal way. A lot of times I'll use a PTT mic, so the HT is in one hand and the mic is in the other. So, yeah, you know, that was a surprise enough for me. Thank you very much for taking my question, and have a fantastic night. K2RIW from KG2RY.
Bye-bye for now, David. Anyone else that I didn't get on the list that has a question or a comment, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW. Okay, there being none, we go over to the second section, which is Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who probably has us a nice puzzle. And by the way, one of the things I remember a week or two ago that was being discussed is the precession of planet Earth. In other words, the point of rotation or the point of the mass North Pole, magnetic North Pole, does move around on planet Earth. And planet Earth does experience precession that goes through a complete, almost a circle, once every 20 or 25,000 years, some crazy number like that. And so somebody was comparing the precession of planet Earth versus the precession of a top. Let me drop. A child's top, while you watch it settling down, you see it move in a particular characteristic way, which is called precession. But that is not pure precession, because that top is experiencing a significant amount of friction, where the tip is touching the floor of the room that you're operating it in. It settles in a particular way, and it doesn't move in a pure precession. Earth, which is in a perfect vacuum of space, and it is getting an upsetting talk added to it, because the equator is a little bit wider than the poles. So therefore, the equator represents a gravity ring that's being attracted to the sun, and therefore the sun is giving it a slight upsetting force, and therefore, in theory, the Earth can do a pure precession where the amount of tilt of that precession could remain constant under certain conditions and would never, go all the way over to horizontal like a top does when it settled down, because that's not pure precession. Let me drop. Now, how fast a Earth approaches precesses is partially a function of its moment of inertia. Inertia is that property, when it comes to translational inertia, Newton's three laws, or one of his laws, is that something sitting still will remain sitting still, something in motion will remain in motion, unless an external force is exerted to it. That's translational inertia. There's also a rotational inertia, something that's spinning, wants to keep spinning at the same rate. And if you change its moments of inertia, in other words, a skater who starts off doing a circular motion with her arms out far and then draws her arms in, because Mother Nature wants to keep conservation of moment of rotational kinetic energy, you will spin faster as you bring your arms in. You're modulating the moment of inertia of the human being when you bring your arms in. So the moment of inertia of the Earth has a lot to do with how fast it will precess. What's unique about Earth, let me drop, it has this thing out there which is one-tenth the mass called Moon, but that Moon is a quarter of a million miles away. And moment of inertia is analyzed by taking the amount of mass and how far it is from the center of rotation and squaring that distance and adding the mass to it. The bottom line is that Earth all by itself has a certain moment of inertia. But when you calculate the moment of inertia of the Earth-Moon system, the moment of inertia of that system is 160 times bigger than the Earth all by itself. That has a lot of effect on how fast the Earth processes, how fast it slows down. As the Moon moves out an inch and a half every year, the rotational kinetic energy of the Earth is being coupled into the Moon. That's part of how that energy transfer takes place. So not many people will calculate the moment of inertia of the Earth system. Earth and Moon is kind of a binary system. And so there's more to that motion than first meets the eye. Put it further in there, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, thank you very much, Dick. I found that fascinating. As always, I want to tell people that if they have any mailbag questions, or if they have any topics, or if they have any puzzles for me to use, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And to look for links on any of the stories that I tell, and sometimes links from Paul. Paul has a YouTube that I have up there that he'd like people to take a look at. And I also included one of my more favorite Veritasium YouTube videos titled This Particle Breaks Time Symmetry, which is about time symmetry and parity symmetry and charge symmetry, which is fascinating. But if anyone wants to watch it and then have any questions next week, we can talk about it. I do have a mailbag question for you, Dick. A gentleman wrote in saying that he was making his own capacitors, and he had an old digital Radio Shack multimeter that had a setting for capacitance. But when he plugged it in and tried to measure the capacitance, it gave a slowly rising number. It didn't settle on anything specific. The longer he kept everything connected for the test, the higher the capacitance was reading as. So I thought maybe you'd like to talk about how multimeters measure capacitance in different ways, and how some ways are much, much better than others.
In an old issue of Electronics Magazine, there was a way of making a very simple capacitance measuring circuit, and it was intended to be applied to a Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, V7 or V3, I'm not sure what the model number was, but the Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter. What you did was to add two extra terminals to the cabinet of that vacuum tube voltmeter, and you put your unknown capacitor across it. And those two terminals were wired in such a way that one of the terminals went to the hot lead of the of your probes. The other lead went to, I think, did it go to the secondary of the transformer or to the primary? I think I went to the secondary of the filament transformer. The filament transformer, I think, was 6.3 or 12.6 volts. So by applying 6.3 volt AC at 60 cycles to one end of a capacitor, and the other end of the capacitor, which is these two terminals that you've added, goes to the input terminal of the voltmeter, and you go to the AC scale, and you could go to the 3 volt full scale, the 10 volt full scale, the 30 volt full scale, the 100 volt full scale, and so on. And there was a chart they gave you with it. But depending on how many volts you measured, it gave you the number of picofarad of that capacitor. What's going on is you've got a beautiful pure sine wave coming out of Con Ed or Loco at 60 hertz, a known amount of voltage. That amount of frequency, 60 hertz, going into your, let me drop, into your unknown capacitor. Your capacitor has a certain amount of capacitor reactance. Let's assume that the capacitor reactance was, for your particular capacitor at 60 hertz, capacitor reactance, let's assume it was 10 megohms, a possible number. 60 hertz is a pretty low frequency. And maybe that would be something like 100 picofarads. I'm not sure, but we can calculate that. And so now, 6.3 volts going through a capacitor reactance of 10 megohms going into the input lead of the vacuum tube voltmeter. The way a vacuum tube voltmeter is made, the input impedance usually is 10 megohms. So in other words, your capacitor has a resistor on the far end that's 10 megohms to ground. That's the meter circuitry. And it's got a source of signal of 6.3 volts going through a capacitor reactance. So you've got a voltage divider in that case. Half the voltage is going to be across the capacitor, half the voltage is going to be across the resistor. So in that particular case, your 6.3 volts would measure on the meter 3.15 volts. So you can see the relationship. That graph and that circuit, very simple circuit, allowed you to measure everything from a fraction of a picofarad all the way up to a few thousand picofarad, as I remember. So in that particular case, if I was using that meter, and if my meter happened to have a gassy tube in there, 6SN7, I think was the tube inside, I could be getting drift of the meter. So I might not get a steady reading. That's a pure guess, drift of the circuitry. If you remove the capacitor, in other words, let me drop. Before you add the capacitor you're going to measure, what does the meter read? It might read a tenth of a picofarad. Does it keep reading that particular number, or does it drift? So you want to find out where is the drift coming from. The possibility of the capacitor drifting, and particularly if you try more than one capacitor, that's very, very unlikely. So the constantly rising measure of capacitance, that's spooky, and I think it's drift. There's one other thing that's interesting with vacuum tube voltmeters. When you go to the very high ohm scale and you put that ohm meter across a uncharged capacitor, your capacitor will jump to very close to zero ohms and slowly rise. In that particular case, the circuitry of your ohm meter is literally charging the capacitor. And the way an ohm meter works, it puts a small amount of current into the unknown resistor and measures the voltage drop. In the case of a fixed resistor, you get a fixed voltage drop, which tells you how many ohms that resistor is. In the case of a capacitor, which is essentially an open circuit DC-wise, by looking at the rate of rise, you can get a hint as to how big a capacitor you put on your ohm meter when you put your ohm meter across that capacitor, particularly on the high ohm scales. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. I tend to agree with you. He was talking about a Radio Shack digital a voltmeter probably from, you know, the late 90s or the early aughts. And the giveaway of what they're using and how they're trying to figure out what the capacitance is that the knob that you select different values to measure, the resistance measurements are the same setting as the capacitance.
Yeah, quite possibly they're telling you to go to a particular knob setting and look at the rate of rise as a way of assessing the capacitance. I mean, how long does it take for a discharge capacitor to go from zero ohms to half scale, so to speak. That would be a way of measuring capacitance of certain range of values of capacitor. Maybe that was the intended purpose of that. In order to really measure capacitance in a steady state manner, you must be applying a sine wave, continuous sine wave signal to the capacitor to measure its capacitance. You cannot get a fixed reading of capacitance with only a DC circuit. You must be putting in a sinusoidal signal. And if that handheld meter from Radio Shack doesn't have a sine wave generator inside, then there's no way it can give you a fixed reading of the capacitance of a capacitor. Over to you, Roy. K2LIW.
I agree with you, Dick. And my gut feeling of what was going on is that there's probably some timer circuit that sets an interval for both nanofarads and picofarads, because there's a selection switch next to the knob. And I think it was completely ruined. It simply didn't stop charging. So what the gentleman was seeing, rather than a certain specific time interval of the charge cycle, he was just seeing the capacitor slowly charging up from the ohm meter. So it was, matter of fact, I pulled the instruction manual for that that piece of equipment, and it was very strange how they suggested that you don't really take the value that you measured as meaning much. So it was, I don't know, Radio Shack worked in mysterious ways. And they pretty much told you that it was sort of make-believe capacitance that they were measuring.
If you ever did see in the owner's manual a schematic diagram of what's inside that meter, you'd be able to recognize whether or not there is a sine wave generator in there. And if it doesn't contain a sine wave generator of some convenient frequency, 60 hertz, 400 hertz, 1 megacycle, 100 kc, whatever, if there isn't a sine wave generator, then I don't think the meter is capable of giving you a capacitance measurement that will give you a fixed reading on the movement, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Roy. K2IW.
I agree with you, Dick, and I don't think it was able to have a sinusoidal signal, and that's probably why, after they fudged it, they made a mention in the instructions not to depend upon the numbers. And it's sort of interesting that if you go and look at places like eBay, the good old Chinese, who I don't understand how they make a profit, are selling something that they say is it's a digital inductance, capacitance, and resistance meter for something like $2.50 with free shipping.
That's a great sounding price. Reminds me of the first time we saw the Bofangs and Wolfongs or whatever, these 2-meter radios, how they're 1/10 the price we're used to. Go ahead.
I will never understand Chinese economics. I understand that the government subsidizes shipping, and that could be rather expensive. I've known people who tried to ship things back to China, and when they're told how much it costs, they just throw the damn thing away and either buy a new one or buy something completely different. But, when I bought a Baofeng, I think everyone, almost everyone, you probably didn't buy a Baofeng. No, you did. I think you mentioned about the narrow bandwidth of it. You can't go wrong. For $20-$25, I mean, for a battery, it costs twice as much for most of my other handy talkies. So it's interesting what you could pick up on eBay. You have to wait a couple of weeks for that slow boat from China, but it's sort of fascinating what you can get.
Comment, N2EO.
Yeah, part of their motivation might be to bury American manufacturers, if you know what I mean. You got it, Rich.
Yes, what you said, Dick, is true. They're trying to take us over. They're not our friends. I buy as little Chinese things as possible. Sometimes we're not able to get American. or somewhere else. I'm a force to buy Chinese, but I don't do it. I try not to.